Hello and welcome to the IC Companies and Markets Show. My name's Ian Smith. I'm the company's editor. On this week's podcast, we'll be asking these key questions. What impact has Hurricane Harvey had on the US oil and gas sector? Does Aveva's reverse takeover by Schneider Electric present good value for shareholders? How is music consumption changing? And how can investors access the changing market? And we'll be calling Simon Thompson again to discuss a couple of small caps with earnings momentum. Joining me in the studio today are our podcast editor, Alex Newman. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm good, thanks, Ian.
And we also have our specialist writer, Harriet Klarfeld. Hi, Harriet.
Hi, Ian.
Alex, let's start with you, because you've taken stock of Hurricane Harvey a fortnight since it hit the US mainland, and Houston, Texas has been right at the centre of the worst of the damage. Now, we're not going to talk too much about the human impact, but we're going to talk about the impact on some of the oil and gas infrastructure, perhaps starting offshore. Is that the right place to start?
Yeah, I suppose that's where the hurricane's path first hit the oil and gas infrastructure in the Gulf Coast, which is incredibly dense. And in the last 10 years, I mean, this is part of the problem, allegedly, that that Houston's been such a boom town in the last 10 years because of the shale revolution, that's ended up accelerating the effect of the flooding in the city there.
Partly because the expanding road infrastructure has kind of reduced those barriers to the path of the water.
Absolutely, yeah. But I mean, you asked about offshore, so I mean, the path went through initially many of the offshore rigs are. That resulted in a number of closures, including Shell had to close two of their major platforms. But then, you know, the real impact obviously was on land, and you know, there's Houston and Louisiana and the Southeast Texas is the center of the US refining capacity. So we had a number of the largest refineries completely offline. As we're speaking now, it's only now that that Shell is bringing its Deer Park refinery back online. That's, depending on who you ask, that's the second or third largest refinery in the US. So there was, you know, there was a huge, huge initial impact on the industry.
And we saw the gasoline price spike. Has it had no impact on the underlying crude price, I'd imagine?
Well, I mean, initially this was seen as quite bearish for crude because the expectation was that the refineries would inevitably reduce their demand for crude. That would lead to an immediate drop in crude prices. I mean, that hasn't quite materialized because generally the refineries have got back up to speed quite quickly. So we've actually seen a bit of a bump in the crude price.
Okay, and beyond the impact on the refineries, where else have we seen damage?
Yeah, well, a number of producers have had to shut in. I mean, most notably for London investors, there's a company called Pantheon Resources, which traded on AIM. They have some drilling projects in the Tyler and Polk counties northeast of Houston. They issued a statement on the 30th of August saying that they had to suspend their operations there. They still haven't updated the market on what the potential flooding damage may have been to their operations. Obviously, it's going to push back their drilling program by a few weeks, but that's the clearest and in terms of valuations of oil and gas companies listed in London, that's probably going to be the most visible impact. So in many ways, I mean, this hasn't, although obviously the human cost you've alluded to and the broader economic cost to Houston, the US, is enormous. I mean, the oil and gas industry doesn't seem to have been too terribly hit.
Do you think that we're going to have to factor in these extreme weather events when we are considering the growth of the US onshore market, which has been a major factor in the oil price and therefore impacts on a lot of UK companies? Do you think that there has been any kind of shift here in terms of the way that we look at the prospects of this industry?
Absolutely. I mean, the news focus now is inevitably on the recovery and the speed of the recovery. Longer term, I mean, I think this presents huge ramifications to the industry because particularly in this year, it seems like it's the hurricane season has got multiple extreme weather events which have either happened or are coming, and the threat that poses to the Gulf Coast. I mean, if we listen to the scientists and you know, the meteorological forecasts, we get the impression that climate change is only going to make these events more likely it's going to increase their impact. And so we're going to be talking less about one in a thousand year flooding events or storm events, and, you know, every few years. So while it may sound like I'm reading too much into one weather event here, and it therefore drawing out its implications for the industry too forcefully, I mean, this is a real threat to the US energy industry, which is completely centered in the eye of the storm, and it will be for, you know, the foreseeable future.
Fascinating. Thanks very much, Alex. Harry, I'd like to bring you in here. So another big story this week has been Aveva, which is subject to a reverse takeover, an agreed reverse takeover by Schneider Electric. Give us some of the background here to this deal, which is a big one for London investors.
Sure. So as you mentioned, it was announced on Tuesday that an agreement had been reached between Aveva and Schneider Electric software business to combine. It's a deal valued at about £3 billion, so it's pretty big. There is an interesting background to this deal in that it's essentially third time lucky, potentially, for the two companies. So they first entered talks, I believe, in 2015, and those talks were terminated. They then picked up again in 2016 during the summer, and then were terminated, I think, about 2 days later.
And was that concerns over integrating the businesses? What do you think?
Yes, I think it was, as far as we were led to believe, it was around the integration of the businesses, but I think the terms weren't quite satisfactory.
So, and in terms of the businesses, how similar are they in terms of the software that they sell?
So Aveva is obviously listed in London, and it provides solutions to some of the world's largest engineering companies.
It's engineering software, perhaps around big projects. So it suffered from the oil and gas retrenchment.
And Schneider's business that will be combined with Aveva also has oil and gas exposure, but it'll bring in exposure for Aveva to other areas as well. For example, food and beverages and pharmaceuticals, among other sort of diversifying sectors, which will be pretty good for Aveva shareholders. In terms of whether we see it as good value or not, I mean, there are two sides to this deal. First of all, when Schneider's software business combines with Aveva, Schneider, if it completes, will get a 60% stake in the combined sort of enlarged company. That obviously gives it a controlling share, and Aveva would be left with 40%. That share of 60%, they think, will be worth approximately £1.7 billion. So it's pretty huge. But there is a significant payout to Aveva's shareholders. So in total, in aggregate, they think it'll be up to £10.14 per share, which we see as a pretty good return to Aveva shareholders if the deal completes.
I suppose the counter argument is that this only takes the shareholders back to kind of 2013 levels in terms of the share price, that you could see it as a company that has been suffering from a cyclical decline in one of its markets, or downturn in one of its markets, I should say. How much value does this actually present over the longer term for Aveva shareholders that bought in, you know, a while ago?
Sure. Well, I think going forward, the boards of both companies really see much greater sort of further growth potential, particularly because Aveva will have more exposure to the North America market. And they said that together the companies will form a global leader in engineering design and industrial software. They've also used other encouraging language, like it's going to have scale and relevance in key markets, as well as an extensive technology portfolio. So these are all obviously positive words. And
is it more meaningful than that? Do you think there's stuff behind that positive words? It is going to meaningfully diversify the group and thus create a more solid business for shareholders over the longer term?
I do believe so. And I think that the fact that they've now tried this three times suggests they do see real value in this deal. So I think it's not just a case for return to shareholders. I think there is going to be much greater growth potential going forward. So we've said accept.
Okay. Another question that will doubtless be asked around this deal: is this another case of a UK tech company being bought because of the decline in sterling? And you said there's been a few attempts now, this is being the third attempt to bring these two businesses together. Do you subscribe to this view that UK companies have become more vulnerable targets because of sterling's devaluation?
I think it's a difficult question to answer. Schneider is obviously a French business, and as you say, it is the third time. But I think importantly, the last two times that talks were announced between the two companies, they were actually before the Brexit vote took place at the end of June last year. So Schneider Electric obviously saw value in combining with Aveva before we voted to leave the EU. Obviously, might look more attractive now. And it does seem interesting that the deal has finally been agreed after the fact of the Brexit vote. And yes, there have been other takeovers, for example, SoftBank recently and Arm Holdings. But I think it may be an opportunistic move to take over a UK tech company. At the same time, we do see more value for Aviva shareholders going forward. So mutually beneficial.
And the share price moved substantially on the news being announced. Interestingly, you wrote about Worldplay and Vantiv. And in that case, Worldplay shareholders managed to push for slightly better terms in the deal, given that it was billed as a merger. I wonder whether there'll be any pushback from Aviva's shareholders about the combined ownership, given that they are going to be, you know, 40% owners, yes, in the combined business.
Well, I think there might be. There's no complete certainty yet to this deal. And I think the vote, there'll be a shareholder vote on the 29th of September at the company's general meeting. But I think with Worldpay, obviously shareholders did see the potential for greater value as part of the acquisition. I think here, as you said, the share price rose a third on the day that the deal was announced. Investors were obviously enthusiastic about the news by the looks of things. And I also think, quite interestingly, there's a clause in the terms of the agreement whereby Schneider can't raise, or it's been limited from sort of increasing its stake in the company beyond 60% for about 3.5 years. So that should give some sort of reassurance to Aviva shareholders, I think, for the time being.
Thank you very much. And let's just move over to the sector focus that you've written this week. I'd like to kind of just talk about it quite briefly because we're going to have Simon on the line. But it's fair to say that the way that we consume music has changed substantially. I'm a user of one of the services provided by the companies in this sector focus. Won't say which one, but it's interesting. A lot of more kind of digital consumption, subscription services has taken off. People were concerned that with the decline in the CD, the rise of kind of digital downloads of music, that music labels would be squeezed out. But in fact, the industry has transitioned over the longer term quite effectively to selling online. If you're an investor, are you still really just restricted to buying into Apple or Amazon if you want access to the kind of changing music environment?
Well, I think what we've explored in the sector focus is actually the various ways in which you can buy into the music industry as an investor. Obviously, a key part of that is looking at the streaming companies. And you've mentioned Apple and Amazon. They have music subsidiaries, respectively called Apple Music and Amazon Music. But apart from that, we also have the private company Spotify. There has been some speculation in the media over the last few months that Spotify might undergo a direct listing on the New York Stock Exchange. From what it sounds like, that would entail potential investors buying shares from existing shareholders with no new capital raised. I don't believe that's been confirmed, but I think that would obviously offer an alternative to investors, albeit on the in the American market.
It would demonstrate whether there really is supply of capital to these businesses, given the competitive challenges.
Exactly. And I think if you take a look at Spotify's most recent full year results, which obviously represent the company as a private company, their losses have been widening. And so that it will be interesting to see how it could fare as a public business if that does happen.
I suppose one of the issues with buying into Apple or Amazon based on the trend towards streaming music is that that's just one part of these absolutely huge businesses that's not a determinant of the share price.
Exactly. And I think we said recently in an article about Amazon, about Apple even, that it does have this sort of significant cash pile, and music is just one part of this huge diversified technology giant, so that it should really benefit from the fact that there seems to be unlimited capital to sort of invest in that sector.
But when it comes to Apple, they are, one of the things they're managing to do is to increase their services revenue. So they are, it is meaningful for them that they are managing to grow this business. You also picked up on a number of kind of the smaller companies that provide services or equipment to various parts of the industry. And I know you'll be a lot of readers that are involved in those. Pick out a couple for us in terms of which companies you think might stand the test of time in terms of their providing, yeah, equipment or services that you think might last.
Sure. So apart from streaming, there's also live music entertainment. I mean, in the US, the giant is Live Nation, but over here on the AIM market, there is Accesso Technology. That has a cloud-based technology platform called Showware, which offers ticketing and queuing solutions. And that is a company that we look at in more detail in the sector focus. We think it could be quite interesting. And there's also Focusrite, which sells software and hardware to a combination of sort of professional musicians and also complete beginners. And I think an analyst I spoke to referred to these people as bedroom guitarists.
Yeah, bedroom musicians is the sometimes familiar or sneering term applied to people like me who record music in their house. And also Gear for Music, another online retailer that I've actually used recently. So there's a few of those options. Another company that I think is quite interesting that I just want to touch on is EVR Holdings, which provides, helps create kind of virtual reality music content. Talk to us a little bit about them.
Sure. So EVR floated on the AIM market last year, and it does exactly what you just said. It provides virtual reality music content. EVR has a platform called Melody VR. It hasn't actually launched yet. It's still in the sort of beta testing stages. And their chief executive, Anthony Matchett, says it'll really be able to launch once the VR headset market becomes more buoyant. So around sort of 25 million to 30 million headsets. It's interesting that this product, which will allow people to experience sort of music concerts via virtual reality, really depends on the VR market taking off. But we think it could be potentially a very interesting prospect.
I think this is fascinating. I watched a Gorillaz music video on just a simple Google headset using one of the Google Android operated phones. And it's a very good experience. So I really recommend any listener to give it a go, just in that you're looking around, there's characters from the Gorillaz, music universe or whatever, the band, the animated characters kind of all around you. And it does create a very immersive experience, kind of audio and visual. So I thought that was quite impressive, and it would be interesting to see how that market develops if we move towards a point where we do consume more music in a kind of virtual reality and mixed with a kind of visual 3D environment. Then the potential market is quite large.
Yeah, I think hopefully, and I think it does offer an alternative to people who might not be able necessarily to afford concert tickets or might not be able to get to their favorite sort of musician. They can sit on their sofa at home and experience a concert from the comfort of their own TV room.
Excellent. Thanks a lot. And now joining us on the line is our stock picking columnist, Simon Thompson. How are you doing, Simon?
I'm doing well. Incredibly busy, like everyone else on the ICs Companies team at the moment. So it's the start of the tsunami of the results season.
And not to mention the finale of the test series.
Oh, absolutely. That could be a nail biter if it's anything like the last one up in Manchester.
Yeah, very much looking forward to that. Okay, what are we highlighting this week from your column?
There's a couple of companies, one of which is Ramsden's Holdings. It's a diversified, fast-growing financial services company. Joined AIM back in February. I spotted a rather upbeat trading statement in April when the house broker, Liberum Capital, upgraded its forecast quite tremendously. Covered the results back in June. Really impressed by the management team. Put the readers in at 132 pence. Target price of 180, well, that target price is long gone. I've had to upgrade it after what happened at the end of last week when the company came out with a trading update, and Liberum, having upgraded their earnings forecast and profit forecast by 13% back in April, have just increased them by 20% again. So for the year-on-year growth through the year in March 2018, we're looking at profits going up from roughly 4 million to almost 6 million, and earnings from 10 pence to 15.3. Stock price is 169 at the moment, which means they're trading at 11 times forward earnings. Cash is building. Cash in the bank is going to increase roughly from about £9.5 million up to 13. £13 million is a quarter of the market cap. So I reckon this company's trading on net of cash in the balance sheet and enterprise value of about 5 times cash profits. That's incredibly cheap, but more importantly, it's the drivers of this business. 40% of the gross profit forecast, gross profit £27 million, but 3% of that is going to come from a foreign currency arm. This is basically what Travelex, M&S, the supermarkets do, provide foreign currency to people going abroad. Well, Ramsden, last financial year, exchanged over £400 million worth of currency with more than 600,000 retail clients. That gives it roughly a 3% market share of the £13 billion foreign currency travel market.
I noticed that you call it a financial services provider in your introductory remarks there and in the column. For some people, this they might see Ramsden's as a pawn broker that does a bit of gold buying, but what you're saying is that actually they do substantially more than that. So the prospects for growth in the foreign currency arm, for example, you're very positive on.
Oh, no, they're tremendous. I mean, basically, having spoken to the directors, they capture a 10 to 12% market share where they've got high street presence. They've got 127 outlets. These are spread across Scotland, northeast of England. They're Middlesbrough based. They've also got outlets in Wales as well. So,
but how good are they to the gold price in terms of the gold buying business? Obviously, you also make the comparison to their larger rival, H&T, and that's a present concern, isn't it, for investors in that business?
No, they do. I mean, they do. I mean, basically, the gold price in sterling terms has gone up 13% since December. It's roughly £1,030 troy ounce. That's only about 12% off the all-time high reached in September 2011, and that's mainly because of sterling's devaluation. The gold side of things, which is basically pawnbroking, that's where they make roughly 20% of their money from. So it's a big part of the business, but it's not a huge part of the business. But when the gold price is actually rising, this allows them to make bigger pledges. I mean, their average pledge size isn't huge. It's only about £192. They've got 33,000 clients. The pledge book is only £6 million. The industry pledge book is roughly £150 million. So they've got a small market share. They know their customers quite well. 85% of their customers actually redeem their pledges. So the problems happen when they have to actually sell the items and actually try and recoup the money. But when the gold price is rising, that mitigates the chance of actually losing money. And the other thing that they've been doing quite sensibly is they've been expanding their retail sites through these 127 outlets, so jewellery, retail sales, and they've been buying goods, refurbishing them and selling them through the outlets. So that side of the business is actually increasing too. So in terms of the pawnbroking side, it's less than a fifth of the business. So I do consider it as a financial services company.
And you think the discount to H&T is undeserved?
It is. I'm very keen on H&T. I included it in my 2017 bargain share portfolio, and you know the shares have done well. But I think there's another probably 15% upside in H&T share price to my target price of 3.75. H&T is trading on an enterprise value to cash profit multiple of 8x. Ramsden is only 5x. I've looked at the numbers again, and I reckon fair equity valuation for Ramsden is about 200 pence a share compared with the share price at the moment of 169. So that gives you roughly 15% more upside. So although readers have done well, I think there is more upside. There's also 4% plus dividend yields, prospective dividend yields. So there is an income on offer. And it's got all that cash in the bank.
Okay, we've got time for one more. What should we pick out?
The other one that really caught my eye this week, and I had a really lengthy conversation with the finance director and chief executive, is Intraded Gamma Aviation. It's an operator of privately owned jet aircraft. It's got a air division and ground services division. Back in February, it did an interesting deal with BBA Aviation to basically merge their U.S. activities into one business, and the benefits of that are actually coming through. I mean, the figures from that business alone, the operating profits increased by 150% to $6 million, or roughly half the total, in the first half of the year. But it was the margin improvement that caught my eye. That increased by 90 basis points to 3.1%, and the target is 5%. And this is a business that generated $119 million worth of revenue in the first half. So obviously, if they can get those margins to keep on climbing, then on that type of revenue, you're looking at quite a big profit uplift. The other parts of the business are doing well as well. The ground services business in Europe was restructured, and profits have increased quite sharply there. They've exited underperforming contracts last year in the European air arm, and as a result of that, margins more or less trebled. Cash generation stands out quite markedly. Operating cash flow was roughly $5.7 million. That's compared with the outflow last year. They sold some aircraft, legacy aircraft that they had on the books. As a result, net debt, which was roughly $20 million at the start of the year, is expected to fall to $8 million by the end of the year. And the benefit of that is twofold. One, for the dividend, but if you've got lowly geared balance sheets and lots of balance sheet flexibility, then it allows the board to actually be more generous. But also, the other thing is that with very low balance sheet gearing, the company can look at potential acquisitions, and I discussed that quite at length with the directors of the company. So it's not expensive. It's roughly trading on 10 times earnings. I've been very bullish on it all year. It's just broken out of a key resistance level at £2.50, I reckon.
What's the risk here with this company? Is it that businesses don't want to or stop spending out on jetting their executives around the place?
Yeah, I mean, you've got economic risk. So with a large part in the US, it's been benefiting from the upturn that we've seen in the US economy over the last 7, 8, 9 years. They've also got Far Eastern business, which is a fledgling business. But all the data that we're seeing, you know, be it from Europe as well, it's actually quite positive. So, yeah, obviously, if there's a retrenchment of corporations in terms of their spending, that would have a negative impact. But at the present time, there's no sign of that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Simon, and enjoy the test match.
I will do, and all the best for the weekend.
Yeah, until next week. And that's about all we have time for this week. Elsewhere in the issue, which is £4.90 and all good newsagents, our big cover feature this week, where we have two linked features. 10 years on from the collapse of Northern Rock, is the retail banking sector fixed in the UK? Big question. So Philip Ryland has written a really interesting feature looking back at the events of 2007 and what has happened to some of the players since and some of the persons involved. And then Emma Powell, our news editor, has written a very interesting analysis of the listed players now and how they've changed their businesses since, and how solid they seem as we stand. So do have a read of that. As I say, we've got a music sector focus. There's plenty more news. There's plenty of results. And I've written a column too, if you get really bored. Thanks a lot, and we'll speak to you next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.